Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hello, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and our guest today is a man of vast experience in the theater and on film, but I suspect more people know him now.
As the voice of McDonald's?
No, not just that. But because he is the star of a remarkable show called Succession on HBO, which is hypnotic.
My mom and I yell at each other if one of us hasn't caught up yet, because we have to talk about it as soon as we watch. And occasionally we stay up till the wee hours of the morning to make sure we do watch it, because otherwise we do yell and someone has to discuss it. Our guest is Brian Cox from one of the greatest places in the world, Dundee, from one of the greatest countries in the world, Scotland. And we are so honored to have you.
Very nice to be here.
Especially because, as I came to learn, you are an old movie fanatic.
I am.
My kind of guy.
It's my passion. I've just recently slightly followed in your footsteps, Leonard. I'm presenting, actually this month, I'm presenting an evening on TCM, which actually, believe it or not, means more to me than any award. The fact that they asked me to present an evening at TCM, you know, I could leave all the other awards, I'm fine, you know, nice, thank you very much, but TCM, that's my heart. My heart is with TCM.
Well,
do you ever come out for the festival?
The festival? No, I never did. I never have.
You should. It's in a few weeks.
I know. Unfortunately, sometimes there's a little thing called work tends to interfere with that.
Work. I've heard of that. I have heard of that. Now, it's, I will say, the best part of it is sitting in an audience with all of these other people who love the movies you love. Mm-hmm. And the energy of that, I mean, you know, because you're a theater person, you know what it feels like when a room is alive. Mm-hmm. And that is very much what the audience feels like, because they want to love everything and they're so excited. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But congratulations. Look forward to your night.
Thank you. I don't know when it is, but it's this month. I know it's April. Mm-hmm. You can see it on the thing. I was watching it the other night, actually, and suddenly my face came on. Oh, wow. I'd forgotten.
Yeah. Now, and your favorite actor is Spencer Tracy.
Absolutely.
Which shows extraordinary good taste.
Thank you.
Seems to me. My wife and I was telling her about this, and when I mentioned that you cited, among others that you name in particular, The Last Hurrah. Mm-hmm. That's a film that just reduces us to tears now.
Well, I'm presenting that.
Oh, great.
That's the one I'm presenting. And the reason I'm presenting is an interesting reason, if you want to know the reason. But the reason is, and it's a kind of weird thing in a way, I talk about it on the program, so I'm sort of jumping the gun, but that's okay. The Last Hurrah is my very favorite director, probably, is John Ford. You know, I'm what is known as a Mic-Mac, by the way. I'm an Irish Scot. You know, I've just done my Finding Your Roots, and I've discovered that I'm 88% Irish and 12% Scottish.
Oh my!
I'm 100% Celt.
Right.
No deviations, no variations. That's it. So, yeah. They hadn't worked together for many, many years, actually. Ford, and I mean, right in the early days. In fact, I think he gave Tracy one of his first breaks. And right in the early days, they worked, but they hadn't worked for a long, long time. I think it was something like 28 years. And then they came to do The Last Hurrah. And the interesting thing about it, because the other film that I presented as a standby film, because there's a license problem with one of the films, was the Bringing Up Baby. Now, Bringing Up Baby was written by Dudley Nichols. Dudley Nichols was also a writer of many Ford films early on. And the correlation is the fact that Cary Grant's character is actually based on John Ford, because John Ford had a kind of crazy relationship with Katharine Hepburn. And because they had done the Mary of Scotland together, and apparently they had a sort of rather tempestuous relationship. I don't know how far it went, but Dudley Nichols, when he was writing Bringing Up Baby, and he knew Katharine Hepp was going to be in it, he thought, what a character. And so he thought Ford, and that's the glasses, the round glasses that Cary Grant wears is Ford. But Howard Hawks apparently wanted to cast Harold Lloyd. That was his plan. But then that fell through, and finally they got the right man for the job. And
Well,
who
it's a
happens
Harold
to be another
Lloyd-like
favorite of his?
character.
What?
The character is a Harold Lloyd-ish character.
Yeah, it is a Harold Lloyd-ish character with obviously John Ford overtones.
Yes. Oh my. Oh my. Tell us what movies meant to you as a boy in Dundee.
Well, in Dundee, there were 21 cinemas in my hometown, and their programs were usually 3 days. The ones in the town, I mean, I was in the town, but I wasn't in the center of the town. They were a week, but mainly when you got out to the hinterland, it would be 3 day programs, and it was double features. So, and I had two cinemas kitty corner to each other. One was called the Broadway, which was on the north side. My church, my library, and the Broadway were on one side, and on the other side, kitty corner to that, was the Royal. So I could see as many as eight films in a week if I was clever enough. And I actually probably did, on occasion, see as many as eight films in a week. Because when my pa passed away and my mum was ill, I just used to spend all my time in this. I mean, I spent it. I started going to the cinema on my own when I was six. So it was it's always been, and it's really where I kind of wanted to, I followed, wanted to be an actor, was from seeing. And of course Tracy, because he was a Catholic, and my mother and I was a Catholic family, and my mother was a huge Tracy fan, because he was she just used to say about Katharine Hepburn and Spencer, she said, oh, they're just friends. They're just very good friends. Said all
She
kinds of
absolved
rumors,
them.
but they're just friends.
Yeah.
So I was, that was my, that, and that was a great link, my ma gave me to Tracy.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So I used to see all those films, and of course in those days a lot of the comedies were, like Martin and Lewis as opposed to Jerry Lewis. And I still love Martin and Lewis films more than I like Jerry Lewis films, because Dean Martin was deeply underestimated as one of the great feeds of all time, and also killingly funny in his own way too. So that was something I was very keen on, I was. And of course the Saturday morning, the serial films, Flash Gordon, Captain Vimeo, Video, and of course Captain Marvel as well. And
Oh.
those,
Yes.
so all of that was my grounding.
I blame my dad constantly that all of my first crushes were either in their 80s, 90s, or dead because I grew up on all those serials. You know,
Yeah.
everything he showed me was like that. Buster Crabbe,
Buster Crab,
he's
yes, right.
dreamy
Yeah,
and
Buster
dead. So it was a little
Crab.
bit confusing to a
Yeah.
young kid when you're
Yeah.
trying to explain, oh, Jess, all of them are gone. Oh, okay.
It's funny.
Everyone you listen to, dead. Okay.
And that's also the thing you said, Jesse, because what I love about TCM is, is they're so omnipresent. And now, because the films I was watching last night, I was watching Elizabeth and Essex, you know, with Bette Davis and Errol Flynn. And apparently they absolutely hated one another. And it's not evident in the film, except there's just two styles of acting going on. There's Bette Davis. And I think Bette Davis is wonderful. Don't get me wrong. I think she's, you know, some of the great performances of all time, you know, now Voyager, you know, amazing stuff. But I don't think Elizabeth is one of her greatest performances. I think it's a little OTT, shall we say, over the top. But and actually, Errol Flynn is rather good because he's very simple. And he knows when he's with Bette Davis, he doesn't have to do anything. He just lets her do all the work. And he just, mm-hmm. And of course, she kept thinking, I just imagine he's Laurence Olivier, and then I'm happy in the role.
Now, people often talk about movies as escape, and that's one of the functions that they serve and always have. But for you as a child, they were more than escape.
Much more.
Can you tell us a little more about that? Because it's really deep-rooted, these feelings.
Yeah, I mean, it was salvation, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, you know, because, as I say, I lost my dad when I was 8, and my mum was, well, she had a series of nervous breakdowns resulting in electric shock treatment, which left a lot of her memory gone. And I was on my own a lot of the time. So, I mean, I had my oldest. I mean, I have sisters. I'm in my 70s now, but my sisters are in their 90s. I still got three sisters, one who's just coming up to her 90s, and the other two are in their 90s. Sadly, my poor brother didn't survive. But they were much older. They had their own families. So I was sort of tossed around like a ball, you know, between. And they were great. They were wonderful. They sort of looked out for me, my sisters, I'm very, particularly my elder sister, I'm eternally grateful. But I did have a lot of time to go to the cinema, and the cinema was just, I don't know, it was my thing, you know. It meant so much to me, and it was just, I don't know, the range of stuff. And it was always American cinema. It was never British cinema. I only developed a taste from British cinema when I got into my teens and when I went to drama school, and I started to realize the beauty of the Ealing comedies and what have you. And of course, my arrival as an actor was like 10 years behind Albert Finney, Peter O'Toole, Alan Bates, who I worked with, I knew them well, and they were much older than me. And that cinema, the free cinema, and that's one of the things I'm doing. I'm actually presenting a Lindsay Anderson film called The Sporting Life on my TCM thing. And that cinema meant a lot to me because it was also about, I think the connection was, you know, America, for me as a kid, even though I didn't know the meaning of the word egalitarian, the work was egalitarian. It was everybody could be anything and do anything. And that was what was exciting. And that kind of went right down to my roots, which are pretty feudal, really, you know, and there is not that feudalism in cinema. It's a much more open, free thing, and it meant so much to me, and just what was being allowed to express in a most extraordinary and individualistic way. So that meant a lot, and I got that initially from my dad, because I remember when I was a kid, I talk about this in the book. I was made to on New Year, you know, Hogmanay is a big New Year celebration in Scotland, and it goes on for days. And I used to, you know, I would go to bed. We had this two-room flat. My mum and dad and my three were in one room. My three sisters were in the other room, and my brother and I slept in the alcove in the kitchen living room. But on New Year, I had to get out of there, so I would go and sleep in my mum and dad's bed, and that my mum would be cooking all night. You know, she'd start cooking, and my dad would be present, you know, and the place would be packed. So then I would be summoned about 1 o'clock in the morning to come in, and I would come in, and my sister May, who was one of my 90-year-olds, she would had a wonderful singing voice, so she'd be singing, and then she'd present me. And I would come on and I would do Jolson impersonations.
Amazing.
On our coal
Amazing.
bunker, we had a bunker in our window recess, which is where we kept the coal. So that was my, and I didn't realize at the time it was my first stage. But what I remember, and it's the thing that always gets me, and you touched on it a bit, Jesse, when you talk about the sensation you get when you go to the festival and the audiences who love those films. It was the community. It was the sense of community and community response, which was so tangible. As a child, it never left me. There was something about the focusing that to that one figure they did. When my sister sang, they did the same. When anybody did what they used to call a turn, they would call it a turn. Now, and that's how we entertained ourselves because we didn't have television. You know, we had radio and we had gramophone records, but there was no television. And when I started, when I was a kid, but that meant so much to me. And I thought, what is that? That it happens when you walk on a stage, or you walk into something, where you walk on a stand on a bunker and sing. What is that that makes this harmony? And you think, how can we bottle it, and how can we make it work for everybody? You know, because it's human beings at their best. You know, so there's a sort of link, a kind of profound link in a way to being an actor for me. You know.
Well, Dundee to me is it's a very warm place, very welcoming. Though most people can't understand what anyone's saying. My
Have
personal,
you been there?
oh yeah, oh
Oh,
yeah,
you've been there. Oh,
yes,
wow.
yes, yes,
Oh,
yes.
wow.
Scotland is my favorite place in the world,
Oh,
and I
really?
love Dundee. And I find that a lot of the smaller cities have this kind of warmth and exactly what you're talking about. And I don't, did you ever perform at Fringe? Did you ever do that, or was that sort of later?
No, I was at the Lyceum. I was a founder member of the Lyceum in Edinburgh, so
I know you are.
I started there. Have I performed on the Fringe? You know, I don't think I have. Have I? I think I've done a couple of talks on the Fringe, but I'm not
Sure,
sure if I've done any
sure.
actual plays or anything like that. But I love the Fringe. I mean, I went. That was the other thing when I was 17, was to go to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And I love my country, and I really do love Scotland. And going to Edinburgh, and that was incredible to see the stuff that went on there. Plus the art, you know. The other thing too, I remember going to the Royal Scottish Academy and seeing a Modigliani exhibition, and I was 17. I had never seen paintings like that, and a painter called Chaim Sautine, and I was. It was a Both they were both being presented, and it was just so profound to me, that level of creation, you
But that's why Scotland is magic.
know.
I genuinely believe that.
Well, my wife feels the same. I have a My wife is German Iranian. Her father's Iranian and her mum's German. And when I took her to Scotland for the first time, she insisted on stop me, and this was like 5 o'clock in the morning. I was driving, and she said, and we were in the Highlands, we were on the way up in the West Coast, and she said, "Stop the car, stop the car." And I stopped the car, and she ran out and she threw herself on the ground, and she
Amazing.
says, "It talks. The ground talks. It talks to me, you know." And she loves it, and I didn't realize it talks, but I suppose I'm so used to it, it's always talked to me.
And you've done so much for the theater, in Scotland, especially. Obviously, you've been on stage everywhere, but you support theater in Scotland in such a major way.
I've
And
tried to,
I have a lot of friends who are very grateful to you for that because of your work, they've gotten to do a lot.
Well, let's talk about that Angry Young Man kitchen sink school of drama and of the opportunities it gave to, as you say in the book, to working class guys like you. You may have admired the Hollywood actors who are so wonderful, but you couldn't see yourself in their shoes. Whereas when you saw Albert Finney and Alan Bates and all those folks, you could see yourself.
I'm so grateful for what happened in the late 50s. And it really started with John Osborne at the Royal Court. It started through the theatre. It came through the theatre initially. There was a sort of, what they call the angry young man, look back in anger. That was the great play that kicked everything into touch, really. And so out of that, you got these actors like O'Toole, like Albert, like Alan, who Alan and Albert were, and subsequently O'Toole. I didn't know O'Toole as long as I knew the other two, because they were great, great friends of mine, both of them, and I worked with both. And it was, and also what happened was, this incredible social mobility when anybody could do anything and you were welcomed. I mean, I, as a kid, I got a grant. I mean, they talk about how they can't, the way people have to pay for educate. Well, you've always done that here, sadly. But in my country, they didn't. We didn't pay for our education. I got a grant. I was going to a drama school. I was 17. I had no real educational qualifications. Apart from the fact that I could do what I could do with my audition. And I got a grant, I got my expenses paid, my living allowance was paid. And it was London in the 60s. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better scenario, really. And it was very exciting. It was very, very exciting. But again, it was this social mobility. You could come from any class. And sadly, that's closed down. That doesn't exist in the same way. I mean, the public schools in the UK have done very well because they've got great theatre, because money has been invested in it. Yep. But if you're a working class kid, forget it. It was much better off in my day than it is now, really. Yeah. And that's very sad. That's really sad. That sort of aches a little bit.
What was it like when you got to meet some of your young heroes?
Oh, well, it was awe-inspiring. Working with Albert the first time, I worked with Albert, I was kind of in awe, just in awe, because this was the guy that made it. When I saw Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, having wanted to be an actor, I thought, how is it going to be possible? And then I saw at the Plaza Cinema in Dundee, I went to see it, and I thought, I see, there is something happening that I can be part of, from my background. And so when I met Albert, it was, and we became firm friends. Because we worked together twice. We worked first at the Royal Court Theatre, and then we worked at the National Theatre. We did a show at the National Theatre. But the first time I worked with him, there was a lot of laughter on stage going up, because we had this body that we had to. It was a play called Cromwell, and we had to move the body around the stage, and it was a body that they used. It was a dummy, a sort of thing that lay there, and it was lying at a particular angle one night, and we were kind of giggling about it. And I remember, and we had one of these wipes that happened where the scene was wiped and then the next scene started. And as the wipe was had, Albert was downstairs trying to act his socks off. And we, Pete Postlethwaite, myself, and a wonderful actor called Alan Armstrong, we were sort of laughing. And Albert grabbed me and he said, "You're not that good, you know." And put me very firmly in my place. And I was terrified. I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry."
And you write that Peter O'Toole was, when you finally got to meet him a little later on, he was well aware of the impact he had on younger actors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that was funny. That was, we were doing Troy. And my very first scene in Troy was I had to kill Peter O'Toole. Now, Lawrence of Arabia is one of the great acting things of all time. And there is my hero, and there I am, and I'm given a spear, and I'm supposed to kill him. So, and of course, I was sitting waiting to do the scene for the. I was at Shepperton, and I'd been there since 8 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't get on the set till about 4:30 in the afternoon, and I got on there, and we did the scene, and there was an effect where I stabbed him from the back, and then the thing had to come out the front, and because he had lots of time fiddling with that. So we finally got on with the scene, and I thought I'd been pretty cool about the whole thing. I thought, man, I've been pretty cool with him. And then finally I did it, and the scene was over, and he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "So how are your nerves now?" And I went, "How did he guess? I thought I'd covered it up." He was quite a character, quite amazing. But it was also, I think, a result of the war. The war did a lot of, there was a lot of clearing by the war that happened. Mm-hmm. And it meant there was this time for the expression of something which had not been expressed until that point, which is why you have films like Kind of Loving, The Sporting Life, Billy Liar, you know, the film of Look Back in Anger, the one with Richard Burton, you know. So mm-hmm. it was an amazing, amazing period.
There was one name that sort of towered above all others in your world, and that was Olivier. Mm-hmm. And you had some interesting encounters with him, and he was actually kind to you.
He was. He actually saved my life by accident more than design. But no, I was working in Edinburgh, and I had an audition to go to the National Theatre, which eventually I got to, but I didn't initially. What happened was it was a Saturday afternoon. I was in those days. You can get a flight from Edinburgh to London. You could get a standby, and it cost you £1.50. You know, 30 shillings. That's what it cost. It was nothing. So I was on standby, and I packed my bag, and we did a matinee. I can't remember what the show was. We were doing a matinee, and then after the matinee, the little stage doorkeeper was called Jimmy. He said, "Oh," I said, "Brian, I found this wee note for you. That it was left at the back of your cubbyhole, and it fell in the back." He said, "And I've only just found it." He said, "It may be quite important. It's from somebody come, Oliver, somebody Oliver." And I said, "Oliver?" He said, "Yeah, Oliver. It's this man Oliver." And I said, "I don't know any Oliver." And I opened the note, and it was not from him, but it was "To meet Sir Laurence Olivier," you know. So then he pronounced it Oliver. So I said, "Oh," and it said, "Unfortunately, Sir Laurence can't meet you this weekend. He won't be able to meet you on Monday, so you'll have to, we'll have to change it to another day." And I thought, "Oh, what the hell," because I'd already decided that I was going, you know, I'd all packed and I was ready to go. So after the show, I went to there's a pub near the Lyceum called the Grindley Street called the Shakespeare, just by the Usher Hall. So I went and sat in the pub, and I thought, "What do I do?" And I had my bag, and I thought, "Shall I get on the plane? Shall I not?" And I just hummed and hawed. And then finally, I thought, "Oh, to hell with it." I had a few jars, so I thought, "Oh, no, I'll stay here. I'll stay home." So I went back to my digs. And the next morning I woke up, and there was a paper called the Sunday Post, and it had slipped, you know, it was in a letterbox, and I could see it was on the floor, and I picked it up and I looked at it, and it had Stop Press. And on the back it said, "Edinburgh flight, late night flight crashes and kills everybody aboard." And that's the flight that I would have been on. And so he saved my life, you know, virtually saved my life, which is odd. Well, not odd, it was strange. Yeah, it was odd. Anyway, so what happened was that later on I met him, and I never mentioned it to him, and I don't know why. I think I was shy. I didn't actually mention it to him. But I did say to him, I said, you know, he said, he was very impressed by my audition. He said, "Look, if you came, you would understudy." The idea was I would have understudied a wonderful actor called Colin Blakely, who was part of that company, and do that line of, actually it was a line of parts that Albert had played, but now Colin Blakely had taken them over. And he said, "You know, you come here." And I said, and I put this, I said, "You know, Solange, I've actually been asked to go to Birmingham, and I've been offered many great roles." And I told him what I'd been offered, and he said, "Then you don't come here, you go to Birmingham and you play those roles." And of course, he had started at Birmingham Repertory Theatre, like a lot of people had. Paul Scofield had started. Albert had started at Birmingham Rep. It was a very famous repertory theatre. So he kind of solved that problem for me, because he said, no, you don't want to come here and understudy, because that's all you'll do for a year or so. So I went to Birmingham, and I'm so, so eternally grateful to him.
You had his blessing to go there.
Mm. I had his blessing. And when I told him the parts that were being offered to play, I played Orlando, Mercutio, Iago, Bolingbroke, and Peer Gynt, you know, which is, and I, this was before my 22nd birthday, so it was pretty.
No, you don't turn those down.
No, you don't. You don't turn those. And in those days, there was so much more of a structure, which is sadly missing now, you know. I mean, if you think of an actor like Ian Holm, for example. Now, Ian Holm was at the He was at the he was at the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company. He was there for about 10 years before he actually played anything. Nowadays, a young drama student expects to be playing a lead as soon as he leaves to go to the place. And of course, it does happen. But the point was, there was a, you know, there was a, you practiced your craft. You know, there was an apprenticeship that you dealt with as an actor before you got to anywhere else where that you started to be substantial, as it were. And a lot of that apprenticeship happened in repertory theatre, and the repertory theatre movement was pretty strong. It's not as strong as it used to be, but it was fantastic in the post-war, you know, and right up until the 70s, really.
Now, despite being a lifelong movie fan, movie buff, was there a kind of a looking down upon movies as an actor's choice?
Not really, because of what happened with the free cinema. I think that liberated cinema a lot. I mean, if you were talking about Doctor in the House and a lot of those Kenneth Moore films, then there was probably a little bit of a looking down, and as it was with pretty poor television. I mean, everybody rushes. There's a program now called The EastEnders, which is a big you know, kind of soap opera, but nobody rushed to soap operas when I was a kid. We were all about doing proper work, so we didn't go to television for that. We would go to television for a good play or a good film or what have you, but we never did, you know. I sort of steered clear of all that. No, there was none of that, really. I mean, the point was, it was just, we didn't look down on it, and certainly not from a point of view of the cinema looking down. I mean, the other thing to me was discovering the theatre. And the theatre had been not in the equation until I went to work there. But then I was very lucky, because the first actor I ever met, live actor as it were, before I met all those guys, was a wonderful actor who nobody remembers nowadays, called Nicol Williamson. And Nicol was a tremendous actor with tremendous range, a troubled soul, sadly passed away. And he didn't do what, I mean, he had this amazing time. I mean, you probably remember this more, Leonard, because he did a one-man performance for Richard Nixon, actually, at one point. And he played a play called Inadmissible Evidence, which he did on Broadway, which he won the Tony for. So, but I watched Nicol doing fortnightly rep, where he was changing roles every 2 weeks, and to see an actor's range and to see what can happen, and where you had to be able to, you know, move like lightning. You know, I look at young American actors now, and I look at them and I say, you know, you can't prepare in the way you want to prepare, because if you were in repertory theatre, you would have no time for it. You know, you just have to get on and do it, you know, and that's it. You're committed to it, rather than having to sort of, well, you know, I don't know if I can feel it. I need to know where I am here. You know, I mean, all that stuff.
I say this all the time. You would not have the opportunity. There's no time. There's no time for you to be method for 7 hours.
No, that's
you have to be.
You've got to be there. And it is, it's the fact that you had to carry, you know, three plays in your head over three weeks, you know, and you had to do it. And the commitment was any less. If anything, it was a lot more, because it was also much more practical that that's what you had to do. You had to have some kind of sense of finish in what you did, even though it was, you know, and that was also the part of being apprenticed, that it was always rough. You know, I mean, the plays I did at Birmingham, you know, if I look back on it now, they were probably pretty rough. But at least it was where I learned the craft. Yeah. And it's the craft that's important to me. Because it's, you know, and everybody, they don't talk about the craft. They talk about, it's got to be, you've got to be, and you go, no, use the imagination. It's like my favorite story about Stella Adler, who I have a great admiration for, going to, you know, when they started the group theater, and Strasberg had this whole thing about, and then they were all so excited about Stanislavski, and Stella went off to Paris to track down Stanislavski. So there was something that she kind of worried about, which was the thing called the emotional memory. And she thought, I'm not sure about that. So she tracked him down, and she said to him, so, Maestro, what about this emotional memory? He said, oh, I forgot about that years ago. He said, I got rid of that years ago. And she said, what? She said, it interferes with the imagination. It stops the flow of imagination. So she goes back And there's this big meeting, the group, and they're all excited to find out, what did Stella find out, what is going on? And so Strasburg's there, and Cheryl Crawford and Bobby Lewis, and they're all there, and he says to her, so what was it like? And I said, well, yeah, it was great. I mean, he was extraordinary, and he did actually say something about emotional memory. And Strasburg said, oh, what did he say? She said, well, he said, it's not helpful. It gets in the way of the imagination. And this is what Strasburg said, then Stanislavski is wrong. And there lies all the bad habits of American theater. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not dishing it entirely, because I think a lot of people do it and a lot of people do well, and it works for some people. But, you know, if you're working repertory theater and you were working, you did fortnightly rep, and so therefore you were doing as many as 20 plays a year.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't help.
Well, the closest thing in the States would have been summer stock.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's the closest thing, where there's no time because you're doing all of these different shows. And the same that's thing right. You're saying about all the different reps, yeah. You know, there isn't that opportunity. One of my favorite things in terms of, you know, you're talking about sort of understudying, paying your dues. I loved hearing Lin-Manuel Miranda talking about busking on the Royal Mile during the Fringe.
Yeah.
Because so many actors and actresses and directors and writers who've been to the Fringe, because most performers in the UK have at some point, mm-hmm. you know, it's that. It's yep. You're fighting to get your audience.
That's right.
You're in a God knows what kind of space you're in. You could yeah. be in a toilet for all, I mean, really. You know, yeah. that
there have been performances in toilets.
So. I would not doubt it for a hot second, but it's, you know, you love it. And yeah. so you're doing it, and it's that's crazy.
Right. And it's right. It's a good point, because you see those kids, and, you know, not even kids, a lot of grown, you know, yeah. older people doing it as well. And the Fringe, I mean, you can see as many as 400 shows in the Fringe.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Now, in terms of your film career, you talk about accepting.
You keep talking about the book, so just real quick, because you have it.
Oh yes, because you keep referring to
the book.
Well, it's called "Putting the Rabbit in the Hat: A Memoir" by right. Brian Cox.
And that's me.
That's you.
It is a great. That's it is you. A great read. If you love theater, if you love film, if you love Brian Cox, mm-hmm. any or all of those three would be reason enough to read this, with a lovely foreword by Frank Rich.
Yeah.
Was one of the executive producers of Succession. Sure.
Yeah.
Now, you talk about accepting and then even embracing the term character actor.
Yeah.
How would you define that term?
Well, I think any actor, if you're really talking about acting, every role is a character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they have degrees of difference. Of course, the one thing that one of the things I love about the cinema is the kind of the virtuoso player, the Cary Grants. But then Cary did have an extraordinary range, which people always underestimate, or Gary Cooper, you know, or James Stewart, which all, you know, there was a sort of similarity, but not. If you yeah. saw the differences in their performance, there were differences, there were very slight, you know. Stewart was a very gifted comic actor, and then he did those amazing Anthony Mann films in the 50s, you know, the Winchester 73 and those movies. So there was a range of acting that you could see. Now, it was also the Hollywood thing, and that was part of, you know, Errol Flynn is a classic example, you know. And also about box office, you know, and they did go down that route. But the thing to me that I loved, and when I made my decision to come here, was I loved the William Demarest, Jackie Gleason's, and that not Jackie, the James Gleason, you know, right. I mean, you know, and Eugene Pallette, and I mean, these were the actors that for me were just so extraordinary, you know, to see them do their stuff and do it time and time again, you know, and I, as I've got older, because I'm getting more like that myself, I really appreciate them more. And And that's a great legacy of the American cinema, those wonderful, wonderful character actors who just, you know, without them, there wouldn't be a cinema of any kind of portent. But they did it. They did the stuff. So when I decided to make the move, and I had this discussion with Nigel Hawthorne on a plane about, you know, and I know Nigel, he was just a South African, he played a lot of English roles, he used to work at the court, and then he got a TV series and he became, you know, and he did King George III and all went on. And but he decided he couldn't play parts after a while because he felt, oh, he was going back. And I just said, I don't think it matters. And it was, what I go to is Michael Powell. When I read Michael Powell's book, he said this extraordinary thing. He said, in films, there are no big parts and small parts. There are only long parts and short parts. You're either on a film for a long time or you're on a film for a short time. And, you know, the people I admire most is the day players, the people who have to come in and make their impact in a day. And, you know, and I've seen some wonderful actors come in and just do that. So I thought to myself, no, I don't think there's any shame in being a character actor, you know, because I think all acting is characters. They're all characters. If you play Lear and you play Titus Andronicus, they're two different characters, but they're characters, and they also happen to be leading men as well, you know. Mm-hmm. So I've never seen that differentiation. I've never really taken that. I don't quite buy it, you know, because I do think there is something intrinsically sort of malleable about acting in that way.
Well, also, some people, many of them, just like to work.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you like to work, it is a job. Sometimes folks forget that it's a job.
Oh, yeah.
And if you have kids, if you have bills, if you just enjoy it, maybe you're not going to get, not everything is going to be a hit, a blockbuster, any, you know,
That's right.
Be work.
That's right. And, you know, I've always found that very odd, you know, that whole thing about, you know, because it is, the joy is the work, you know, and I'm a workaholic. I mean, I'm a self-confessed workaholic. I mean, if I have 5 minutes off, I think I should be doing something, you know. So, I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right about that. It is the work, and it is, you know, and that's what feeds you, you know, and I think I'm a very good example of that because, you know, I've danced with this profession for a long time. You know, I'm now in my 60th year since I was 15, and I've danced with, and I've had great success, I've never got to the point where I'm, you know, like now I've lost my anonymity. People know who I am, and they're always coming and asking me to use the F word to them on a regular basis. So, you know, and it's, you know, that's the easiest thing to say to somebody when they come and say, could you say, and you go, off, you know.
You don't even have to ask.
Ask. It's more easy. You can get it for free. And sometimes they're willing to pay to be insulted, you know. It's a crazy world we live in. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, I'm grateful the fact that, you know, now I'm playing a role that, and I warn the kids on the show. I say, look, this is a great show and you're all great in it. And I said, but you know, some of you are in your 30s. Mm-hmm. You want to be going on acting. This will finish and you will want to go on to something else. But, don't get too comfy with the role that you've got, because you know that you're going to have to keep on going if you still want to have a profession, if you still want to treat it as a profession. And that's what I'm still trying to do, even with Logan. Since I finished the last season, I'm now working on my fourth picture, you know, so just to keep it going, you know, keep the work going.
Yeah,
sure. Now, you talk about the fact that some people say, well, Logan is just Rupert Murdoch, you know, in Mufti. Yeah. But you don't see it that way.
No. I don't see it that way. Well, the big difference is, and what to me is interesting, and you know, I kind of more or less agreed this with Jesse, our creator, is he's a self-made man. You know, there's nothing inherited about him. The only inheritance that he's got we don't know, it's pretty murky, it's pretty tragic, I think. But he's become a self-made man, and he's a misanthrope. You know, he's lost faith. And I think it's understandable that particularly if it reflects on the world that we live in today, faith can get lost very easily, you know, and it can move you to the right, and it sometimes can move you to the left, you know. And I think that we live in a more polarized world than we've ever lived in at the moment. And so Logan is someone who is kind of representative of that polarization, you know, that he's, I mean, I think that in many ways we have a lot in common, because we are both disappointed with the human experiment, you know, except I'm an optimist, Logan right. isn't. Logan is a pessimist, and he's a misanthrope. I'm not quite a misanthrope. You know, I have misanthropic tendencies, but I'm not totally the misanthrope.
But that, you know, that character is such the, I think it's a lot of people's stories to a degree. What do you do as a parent? You want to give your kids everything you didn't have.
Exactly.
So if you come from nothing, you work really hard to be able to give them everything.
That's right.
Except that then they don't necessarily have the same mentality you did. And yeah. obviously in your case in the show, it's extreme because of the wealth and everything else. Yeah. But it's also just the reality in general, yeah. you know?
Well, it's interesting you pick on that, Jesse, because I'm about to do a documentary, presenting a documentary before we start Succession, about money, and really about the power of money, and what the difficulties that enormous wealth has, and the obvious difficulties of poverty, and seeing the contrast between the two. You know, part of the show, I'm going to be talking to the Amazon workers that are trying to form a union, you know, right. why do they form a union? And then I want to get the other side of it, though I don't think Jeff will actually speak to me about why he doesn't want a union, which is that it's obvious why he doesn't. But yeah. there are people who do. There are people who are very rich who will go there and who will talk about things. So I'm doing, that's what I'm doing now, because I just want to see, is money the root of all evil? Is it a power of the good? Because it affects us all, you know. We all, you know, we're all ruled by our fiscal income. You know, that's the way it is. And I mean, I did this Finding Your Roots, which I was telling you about earlier on, and with the wonderful Skip Gates, and I discovered that he went back on my maternal grandmother's line. He took me back to 1650.
Wow.
And most of those people ended in the poorhouse. Most of the people, I mean, it's a wonder I'm here. It's a wonder that anybody survived, because of the level of poverty that went on. And it's like, it's so common. And then I go to the other strains of my family, and they had the same problem. And, you know, they kept their head above water. So I've realized that I'm the first person in 350 years that's actually made any money.
Wow.
You know, I'm the first person who's actually made money. And it's kind of bizarre. And I look and I said, no, historically that shouldn't be, because historically, and my poor dad suffered from, he was nearly the first person to do it, but then all went, because he died within 3 weeks of his diagnosis, and at a very difficult time when he invested money that he lost. So it's a kind of weird thing, you know, that we are, it's a, you know, that we have these issues in our life, you know, which are sometimes essentially private. But for me, it's, poverty is like the sword of Damocles that hangs over my head.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
That doesn't go away. That doesn't go away easily for anyone.
No, I don't think so. And I don't think we talk about it enough.
No.
I think it's something that we don't talk, and that's what I'm hoping the program will do, that we'll talk about it, we'll actually look at it, and we'll look at the benefits of it, and also the downside and the upside, and also what does it mean not to have it, you know, not to be in a position. So it's a kind of thing, but it's also, I think I'm blessed, because it's a kind of awful thing to say, but I'm blessed in many ways because of what my folks went through. I was in a kind of no man's land for so long, you know. So out of that no man's land just came a work imperative, and just realized it's, and Chekhov talks about it. He talks about work. We must work. So, you know, it's at the end of Uncle Vanya, Sonia says to Vanya, we must work, Uncle Vanya, we must work. And that's the truth. We just have to work, you know.
Well, I'll tell you the biggest difference growing up in Los Angeles, as I did. I'm one of three people from LA. And it's the strangest thing is growing up with all these kids whose parents do the same thing. Essentially, everyone's in the entertainment industry, right? And many of them are very, very wealthy. And a lot of those kids benefit from the wealth, obviously. You know, we went to a good school, a private school, and all the rest of it. But the biggest difference for me is I saw my dad work every day. A lot of the kids didn't see that. And so for them, money just appeared.
That's
right. Me, I saw my dad go to work every single day. I knew he was going to screenings. I knew he was writing. So I knew that we were very lucky that we were in a nice house, but I also knew that it didn't just happen.
Yeah.
And it's a big difference.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Absolutely. You know, right.
Big difference.
Among the hundreds of things, and I'm not exaggerating, hundreds of things that
you've done. Yeah.
You've done quite a lot of cartoon voice work.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy that?
Yeah, I like the voice. I love one of my favorite media is the radio. Mm. I love the radio more than anything else. And of course, it's something that ceased to happen here. And, you know, you had a fantastic radio tradition in the 30s and 40s and 50s, but you allowed it to slip away. Mm. I think you should somebody, you know, it's interesting that the podcast is basically the radio coming back to haunt everybody.
Right.
You know, and I think that's a very healthy thing. I think that, and I think that's the gift of COVID. You know, the gift is that we're into the podcast now, and everybody likes the podcast. And I think, well, yeah, but we've been doing it for years, you know, centuries. It's a century now in the UK. And radio to me is my passion. I mean, I went back to do a play in London. I used to do a radio series called McCleavy, which I play an Edinburgh detective, and I did it for 12 years. And they revived it recently because when we finished it, he left Edinburgh and he ended up in San Francisco. So we've just done the first San Francisco, but I was... The fare going there cost me more than I was getting paid.
Of course.
But I didn't. But I'm in a position where I can afford to do that.
Right,
you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And I love it because I just love the radio. I just. You don't have to put any clothes on. You don't have to wear any makeup. All in the voice. You know. And I love the voice. And you know. And especially if you have a tradition of we have of great speakers, you know, and that's one of the things. It's very interesting. I was watching a young actress the other day, and my wife's doing this wonderful play in New York called 7 Minutes, which is about a strike that happened in France, but they've set it in Connecticut, and it's 11 women on stage, and they work in the fabric industry, the weavers and spinners and stuff, and they're given an alternative that they have to give up 7 minutes, and then the works convener for them says this is wrong because the ramifications mean you're actually going to give up a lot less. Now they had a girl who had COVID, and she came back, but she had to wear a mask on the stage. But the interesting thing was, I'd seen the show 3 times. It transformed her performance because she had to be clear with the mask. And also she became more physical because she used the body more. And I was talking to her. I said, you know, that's a gift. You've just been given a gift. And she said, yeah, I know. She said, it's so weird what's happened to me. She said, I feel different. And I said, well, that's the voice. You know, that's what can happen. You need the voice. And if you overcome that, into something else. And that's fascinating, just fascinating what it does to the work.
Well, it was a big part of old Hollywood as well as movies.
So yeah.
All those actors worked in radio as well.
That's right. And they had to project. And especially when the mics were so far away, they still had to project.
Yeah.
That marvelous sequence in, singing in the rain, you know.
Yeah.
They put in the mic.
Yes. When did you do your book? When did that come out?
Long time ago. But
he did a book.
I wrote a book called The Great American Broadcast about the golden age of American radio. I'll get you a copy.
Yeah.
And, I'd love that, Leonard.
And almost every actor I interviewed mourned the passing of radio. Mm. They loved the medium.
Though it's still alive and well here in our house.
In our house.
It was raised on Jack Benny.
Oh, you know? Wow. Yeah. I mean, of course, Wells, and that was a great thing about Wells.
Yeah.
He was a master of it, you know, because he had that voice to start with, you know, and he was an absolute master. Now, I think that radio, you underestimate radio at your peril, really.
Mm-hmm. Yes, true. Very true. Well, we don't underestimate you.
Never.
you are a master at your craft.
Thank
you. And might I say at your art as well.
Thank you.
And we love watching you on Succession. We love watching you, period. And
and you take care of the other actors really beautifully. I've seen the way that and all these different events and stuff. You take on a not a Logan role, but a nice father role.
Yeah.
All of them.
I am the sort of paterfamilias for the group. So it's one's responsibility and you have to do it, you know.
But not everybody does. You know, not everybody does. And you do a beautiful job of it.
But it's because it really is because of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there are, you know, tradition can be, you know, debatable, but I think tradition in the theatre is so important.
Absolutely.
It's so important because it means you carry the respect for the work and the respect for your fellow artist as well. And that's so important. And you know, and I believe that that's what I got and that's what I've had for 60 years. I've had a great tradition. I've been part of a great tradition and I want to continue that tradition.
Well, you're doing it. You're doing just that. Well, again, Brian, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leonard. Thank you, Jesse. Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you too. He loves your book and I hope everybody has an opportunity to read it because I think that they will just be bowled over in a very big way.
Great.
Well, that's a legend. That is a living legend. And
he embraces that continuity and tradition, which he was witness to and the beneficiary of. And now he is, in fact, passing it along.
I will say to anyone listening, if you are someone who is, let's say, the adult of a situation, by which I mean, you know, you have the opportunity to help others, to help guide them in whatever it is that you do, even if it's not in the arts. If you have the opportunity to be kind to someone and help them at the beginning of their career, it means the world. And it also means that it's going to get passed on. It happened for you.
Yep.
You had a lot of people be very kind to you, and that's why you've been kind to a lot of people since then.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, people will come up to me and tell me how much they appreciated the way that you treated them early in their career.
Well, because I had people who taught me.
Exactly. So if you are someone where you have that opportunity yourself, please, you know, take a moment. It's not hard. Take a moment because you don't know how much it can alter someone's life entirely.
All true and well said. And if people want to,
I love your transitions. And if people want to do a thing on the, yes, if you would like to find us on the internets, you are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. You are also on Facebook. You can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff. I know you'll be writing about Brian's book, and that will be up on the website. And I love when you read a book and basically my mom and he's our living Cliff Notes. He reads and my mom and I, who are terribly dyslexic, we just get all the great stories.
I live to serve.
You do.
Okay. And if you want to help us support what we do, you can go to patreon.com/Maltin on Movies, patreon.com/Maltin on Movies. And I do special columns every month, and we have other ways to thank you for your support. And beyond that, we look forward to seeing you next week.
Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.